It's How to Be Amazing from PRX. I'm Michael Ian Black.
You know, if you're doing a mathematical calculation, it's all falling into place. It kind of feels like, you know, the universe is just right there. That's why this is all working.
Today on the show, Professor Brian Green takes us on a journey out to the edges of the universe and right to the center of my nerdy, nerdy soul.
You don't seem convinced from that little discussion.
I mean, far be it for me to argue with Einstein. Guy was a hack.
Not going.
Brian is a theoretical physicist who spent his career figuring out our strange universe and then explaining it so people like me can understand what the hell he's talking about. But to hear the guy speak, you'd think he was talking about composing a symphony.
It's all about finding, you know, harmonious, beautiful, unexpected patterns.
I've always wanted to understand how scientists can make that incredible conceptual leap from an equation on a page, you know, just a bunch of numbers sitting there making me feel stupid, into a breakthrough that changes our understanding of reality. Well, that's what this guy does. In this episode, Brian Green on the beauty behind the numbers and how to inspire a whole new generation to ask the big questions.
We are all trying to figure out why we're here, why the universe is here, what it's all about. So there always are these deep unknowns that drive us forward. You have to be excited by those deep unknowns. You should be excited by those deep unknowns.
This is How to Be Amazing. You are a professor at Columbia. Your lectures are packed, lines out the door. People scalping tickets.
Yeah, since they're free.
Girls throwing their bras at you while you speak. Your background sort of lends itself a little bit to being a natural performer, and your father was a vaudeville performer, and you yourself have taken acting classes, I guess, into your adult years. I don't know if you still do it.
No, not anymore.
Is there a... What for you is the relationship between the performative aspects of what you do and the more intellectual aspects?
Well, you know, I view nature and the universe as having provided us the most dramatic scripts, you know, the most
nice.
Rich, the most rich material that you could ever imagine, right? Better than any Hollywood sci-fi script or anything, because the stuff of quantum mechanics and cosmology and relativity blows all of that stuff that just comes out of a screenwriter's mind out of the water.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Better than Battleship Earth?
I think so. So if you can find ways to take that material and bring it out to the world in a manner that feels and captures the drama of both the ideas and the discovery, you've got material that an audience just loves to hear about. So I have spent some time trying to do that in various formats because to me it's kind of tragic that so many people view science in the way that the textbooks present it, which doesn't at all feel like some wondrous script, some wondrous dramatic story of discovery, and that's really sad. So I've tried to take this material and bring it out to the world in ways where it will capture that excitement.
And you've done that with your World Science Festival.
Yeah.
And you're doing that now with the World Science U?
Yeah, World Science U. So World Science U is sort of an extension of this way of looking at things because with, say, NOVA programs or books I've done or World Science Festival, the goal there is all about inspiration, right? I don't care. In a 60-minute NOVA program or a 90-minute World Science Festival live program, you're not really going to teach any deep science, but you can get an audience member, a viewer, to say, wow, that was really exciting. I want to learn more about it. And what World Science U is, it's a place where we're now providing a place where somebody can learn more about it without, you know, enrolling in college or going to graduate school. The idea there is to take the ideas of science, make them highly visual, also mathematical. So we're not putting the math to the side in World Science U. It's a place where you can dive in and learn the material on your own, but in a very visual way. And I think that's the key thing for abstract ideas to become intelligible.
Well, I know I've signed up for a couple courses on various online learning sites, and I get bored about two lectures in because I'm usually just watching a guy on a stage
lecturing the way he does normally.
Yeah, right. And to my mind, what that is it's just taking the computer and using it as a new delivery vehicle for old-style traditional teaching. So our approach was to not do that. I don't know if you've looked at any of the World Science U stuff, but you know, I'm the first one who's teaching in it. And yeah, I am doing some lecturing, but I'm not in a classroom with a blackboard. We've got these sort of high-tech plexiglass screens where I can show animations and I can write on them and I can annotate imagery all in real time in front of you. But then we also have beyond that, we have I sit there and answer a whole slew of questions that naturally occur to students, as I know from teaching over the course of many decades. We have hundreds of problems which I solve with you. I take you by the hand. We've got.
Let's be honest. You solve, and I.
No. You work with me. You work with me. We also have interactive demonstrations, so you can actually play with the ideas after learning them. So it's not a passive experience. So all of these, I think, are baby steps in the direction of creating an online environment where education is completely different from the traditional classroom.
Have you thought about the challenges of education beyond your specific field and the kind of I don't know what it is. I mean, I have two kids and you know, they feel bored in school.
Yeah.
I felt bored in school. Have you thought about those ideas and what to do?
Yeah, and it's a big challenge but also a big opportunity. You know, one of the things that we did was, you know, I believe that kids can really grasp some of the most esoteric ideas even easier than adults sometimes. So I did a piece with Philip Glass called Icarus at the Edge of Time, which is a stage piece that has a narrator, a full orchestra that, you know, Phil wrote the original score for.
Tons of vibrating strings.
A lot of vibrating strings. And it's a story about a boy going to a black hole. And his dad says, don't go, just like in the original Myth of Icarus, but the boy is not with the wax wings going to the sun. He builds a spaceship and flies to a black hole. And the key thing is what happens to him there is dictated completely by the physics of Einstein's general theory of relativity.
Icarus heard the voice of the commander, his father, over the address system. All hands to stations, race for emergency course diversion. We're navigating to avoid an uncharted black hole. A black hole? Cool! Instead of strapping himself in, Icarus dashed to the ship's bridge. Son, cried the commander, get to your console.
Oh, Dad, come on!
Here we go! On he went, perfectly executing a glancing trajectory as he momentarily swooped to a hair's breadth above the point of no return. The runabout performed exactly as he had calculated, easily pulling away from the black hole's edge. Icarus's entire being pulsed with excitement. I did it! Let's try that again!
And just to, you know, spoiler alert, so he spends about an hour at the black hole, comes back to show his dad what he's done. But when he comes back, it's 10,000 years later because black holes slow the passage of time. So an hour for him was thousands of years for everybody else. So, you know, it's a story that any kid can understand. And by virtue of going for this ride in the story, they learn a key piece of physics. You know, it started as a book. And when the book came out and I got the first copies, I didn't want to give it to my son, who was five at the time, because I didn't want it to be, oh, yeah, dad's book. It always makes me read this thing, you know. So I left the book around the house, like many copies I left around the house, you know. So he finds one, asks my wife to read it to him, and she read it. And by the end, he's crying because, you know, the boy loses his dad, you know, thousands of years in the future. But the wonderful thing about that is people ask me, well, aren't you feel bad that you made your son cry with this story? It's like, no. If general relativity can make a five-year-old cry, that's good. Science is meant to be something that really affects us emotionally. And my son, for weeks after, was asking things like, well, like if the black hole was smaller, maybe it wouldn't have been 10,000 years. Oh, maybe if the boy didn't get so close, would that have made it so only a few years? Maybe his dad would still be alive. So he's really trying to think about the ideas, and I think that is what we need to have more of in the classroom. Take the big ideas and get kids to think about them.
See, I'm feeling vindicated here because I make my kids cry all the time, even without science.
Stephen Hawking came and gave a series of lectures when I was in college, the Loeb Lectures at Harvard. And there was this figure who could barely speak at that time. He didn't use the voice synthesizer. Instead, he had a graduate student put his ear right next to Stephen's mouth. Stephen would kind of mumble into the graduate student's ear, and the graduate student would interpret it for the audience. So this was a remarkable situation of this man who could barely move, whose mind was soaring out to the cosmos. And everything that he was talking about was about gravity, about the Big Bang, about cosmology, all this wondrous stuff. So I remember after the first of those lectures, I immediately went to the bookstore and I bought a book on general relativity, which is Einstein's theory of gravity. It was Steven Weinberg's book, and I would carry that book around me. And I would look at that book, you know, almost lovingly, like I kind of caressed the cover. I so wanted to know what was inside this book. But I wasn't ready at that point. I couldn't understand it. But within a couple of years, I could. And Einstein's theory of gravity is so seductive. It uses these beautiful ideas of geometry, applies them to the physical universe, and in that way describes gravity with greater precision than ever had been achieved before. So it's just a breathtaking combination of the most beautiful mathematics together with the most powerful force governing the universe on the largest of scales, and put those together, and it's a kind of intoxicating mix.
I can kind of glimpse into the elegance of that, and have had such a strong desire to sort of understand that on a deeper level. Can you give an example of what you mean by this kind of beautiful mathematics within gravity that
yeah.
will help people who maybe don't understand?
Yeah, so people...
And by people, I mean you.
So mathematicians in the 1800s, people like Riemann and Gauss,
yeah.
were the great mathematical minds.
Guys,
yeah,
best.
You know, the
love
ones
those,
that you love
those
guys. Yeah,
yes.
Right. I see you have tattooed Gauss on your arm there. They developed mathematical machinery that could describe how shapes curve.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very tight and beautiful mathematical structure that allows us to describe how a sphere curves or how a saddle curves. And this mathematics was really developed in abstract. It was to describe shapes and objects, you know, in the world around us. The power of Einstein's intellect was to recognize that the universe itself has a shape. Space itself can warp and curve like a sphere or a saddle shape.
And was he the first to have that insight?
Absolutely. You know, it is one of those monumental moments when before he had this idea the world was one way, and after he had this idea the world was a different way. So he recognizes that space and time are kind of alive. He breathes life into them. Before, they were kind of an inert backdrop, just the stage within which the events of the universe take place. After Einstein, he says, no. Space and time are participants. They warp and curve in response to what is within them. And as they warp and curve, they affect the stuff that's within them. And then that causes the stuff in space to move, which affects space and time's curvature. And there's a wonderful interconnected dance, all choreographed by the mathematics of general relativity. So that is the structure that Einstein put forward. And it is perhaps the most beautiful theory ever conceived.
Can we talk about maybe the most famous equation out there, E equals MC squared, Einstein's special theory of relativity? What question was he trying to answer in even coming up with that?
Yeah, well, it's a funny thing. So E equals MC squared was kind of an afterthought for Einstein. It occurred in a paper in September of 1905. But the real breakthrough of the special theory of relativity, which led to that equation, occurred in the spring of 1905, some months earlier. And what he was trying to do in that work was really understand light, how it travels, why its speed seems to be constant. The speed of light is constant, a phrase we all know in the culture, but it means that if you run toward a beam of light, it approaches you at the same speed as if you were standing still. That's kind of crazy, right? If you're at home plate and, you know, Tanaka's pitching on the mound for the Yankees and you run toward that fastball, it'll approach you more quickly than he threw it because you are adding to its speed by running toward it. With the speed of light, that doesn't happen. You run toward a beam of light that's coming toward you, it still approaches you at the same darn speed as if you're standing still. Einstein wanted to deeply understand these ideas, and it forced him to rewrite our understanding of space and time. That's really what ultimately emerged from this study. And then a few months later, he realized, aha, this rewriting of space and time also rewrites our understanding of mass and energy and shows that they're linked together in a surprising way, much as he had earlier found that space and time are linked together in a surprising way. And E equals MC squared is the mathematical articulation of the link between mass, that's the M, and E, which is energy. So that formula says take a certain amount of mass, multiply it by this number, C squared, that's the speed of light squared, and that is the amount of energy in principle that you could extract from that mass.
Is there a way to help me understand how he even knew to combine the ideas of mass and the speed of light and energy? I mean, how do you look at mass and decide, yeah, if I just maybe multiply that by the speed of light squared,
yeah,
I'll
sure.
get energy?
You know, Einstein himself described it later in life as a storm having broken out in his mind in the spring of 1905. See, he had been struggling with these ideas about light and its properties and speed since he was about 16 years old, which was 10 years earlier than 1905. And he would go through all of these so-called thought experiments, Gedanken experiments, where he would imagine crazy things like what would the world look like if you were riding on a beam of light? And if you're riding a beam of light and looking at a clock, would the clock change or would the light not be able to reach you so the clock would appear frozen in time? All sorts of things like that he would struggle with. 1905, in a way that I don't think I've ever experienced, maybe no human being ever has, this flurry of activity in his brain, you know, this whirlwind just kind of coalesced and crystallized into this new perspective on space and time. Now, to parlay that into E equals MC squared, where does that come from? Well, Einstein said, look, if I consider objects that are moving toward each other and say they slam into each other, the natural question was one, now that he understood motion really well, he could analyze in detail and ask a question, what happens to the energy of two objects if they slam together and they stick together? Think of like two pieces of chewing gum. You know, they hit each other and they slam together. Now imagine there's no air around. It's a perfect vacuum. There's no way for energy to escape. Where does the energy that the chewing gum had from its motion, where does it go when they collide and they're no longer moving? Well, he said, well, it must go into the heft, the mass of the bigger glob of chewing gum that is created. So the energy of the motion gets turned into the mass of the bigger blob. And when you work that out in detail, E equals MC squared is what emerges. You don't seem convinced from that little discussion.
I mean, far be it for me to argue with Einstein. Guy was a hack.
Nah, go ahead.
No, but what goes on in my head is kind of that wonderful moment you described where there's a storm in his mind. And the kind of mysterious processes that he was undergoing that allowed him into that to have these kinds of insights. And that kind of creative work, I think, is maybe missing in the way we learn about science and the way we learn about math. And it's that creative work that I find so intriguing about this whole field. What do you think? What's the creative part of your job? How do you marry creativity and the kind of dry mathematics?
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, when we teach these subjects to students, we often kill the life, kill the creative spark that was required to reach the results. By the time they get into the textbooks, we've kind of tried to make it seem logical and systematic, and every step follows from the other. But that's almost never how the great ideas of science and mathematics are actually discovered.
Or in any endeavor.
Yeah, right. So it's you know, we try to find a very efficient path to teach students. So you don't want to take them down the blind alleys or the wrong ideas that were followed before the right one was found. But I think that's really where the life of the subject is. So to your question, you know, how do I work? I work often by example. So there are some physicists who always are at the most abstract level of analysis, always trying to look at the big picture and do analysis that can give them some insight into whatever, the expansion of the universe or how the universe began. I like to, in my day-to-day work, go the other direction. I take small pieces of a subject. I work out mathematical features, and I try to find patterns between the various things that I'm calculating and then extract a bigger overarching idea from the individual examples themselves. And there's a huge amount of creativity that comes into the story because, by definition, you're trying to find something new, something that nobody has seen before, a pattern that is deeply buried. And that requires allowing you, your mind, to make links and connections between things that otherwise would be disparate.
He said that my best teachers, this is a tweet from February 5th, he said, my best teachers were not the ones who knew all the answers, but those who were deeply excited by questions they couldn't answer.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, if that sounds like a kind of perfect summation of, I mean, not only science, but in a way, the kind of human condition.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, if you aren't excited by the things that you don't know, then how are you ever going to excite others to try to get an understanding of things that they don't know? I mean, life is this incredible journey. It sounds like, you know, new agey nonsense, but it really is, right? We are all trying to figure out why we're here, why the universe is here, what it's all about. So there always are these deep unknowns that drive us forward. You have to be excited by those deep unknowns. You should be excited by those deep unknowns. You know, I once had a teacher, in fact, not too far from where we're sitting right now, over at IS-44. And I asked him some questions about circuits. I remember this well. And he turned to me and said, a fool can ask more questions than a wise man can answer. Why? Because he couldn't answer my question. So he basically called me a fool, you know? And that was not a good thing, you know? And fine. But,
right.
but you know, you want the reverse, you know?
Yeah, I was
gonna
say.
Other teachers who I'd ask things, they'd say, oh, my God, that's such a good question. Let's try to figure it out. There's sort of the stark contrast between the two.
The other way to look at it is maybe it was just a dumb question.
In retrospect, I'm sure you're right.
but you know, to bring the conversation kind of full circle, or maybe, I don't know, maybe it's on a tangent. When we're talking about these questions, and I'm speaking broadly about questions, it seems to me that the mathematics that you're discussing and the physics that you're discussing and the acting that we touched on and the writing that you do, all of it feels like of a piece, that this kind of creative endeavor really speaks to this larger idea that all of us are at our best when we're seeking answers to questions. Is there a link between mathematics and language and metaphor? Are they kind of versions of the same thing?
I think they are. I mean, to me, mathematics is the sleekest, most powerful language for articulating certain specific questions about the universe and using that language to try to inch toward answers. But every mathematical sentence can be transcribed into ordinary English or ordinary French, right? It's just that the language of math is better suited for the kinds of conversations that seem tailor-made to describe the universe.
Mm-hmm.
That's really all that it is. And it is all ultimately geared toward the same kind of truth. Now, having said that, there are these distinct pathways toward truth which are sometimes in resonance and sometimes not. I mean, my brother is a Hare Krishna. And in many ways, we have been thinking about the same questions all our lives, just from very different points of view. He's deeply interested in how the universe began and why we're here. And every time we have a conversation, I talk about something we describe or discovered in physics, he says, oh, yes, we know about that Vedic text, you know, 22 or something. And you know, I never really
that's
know.
That's going to be somewhat deflating.
Well,
yeah,
I never
Brian,
really know.
We know.
I really never know what that means. Is it just a resonance of language and resonance, you know, no pun intended? I mean, oftentimes, if in string theory we're talking about vibrating strings and we use the word vibrate and the word vibrate is in the Vedic text, then it sort of feels to the uninitiated that maybe it's the same thing. And they're not really the same thing. It's just a kind of brushing up against certain key ideas. But in physics and mathematics, we take those ideas in the language much further than in ordinary language. So yes, there can be similarities, but we really mean very specific things. When we do a calculation of the magnetic moment of an electron and can calculate it to 10 decimal places and then do an observation and agrees with the math to 10 decimal places, that is unparalleled in any other approach toward truth in terms of that level of precision.
So is it fair to say that mathematics is the fundamental language of the universe?
Some would say that, and there are days when I feel that that is correct. You know, if you're doing a mathematical calculation, it's all falling into place. It kind of feels like, you know, the universe is just right there. That's why this is all working. But there are other times when I take a step back from it all, and it really does feel to me much along the lines of what I was just saying, that all it is a language of human evolution, human discovery that we overlay to try to make sense of patterns in our observations about the world, so much so that I can imagine that one day we encounter aliens and they ask us, okay, what have you guys figured out? We bring out our math textbooks, our physics textbooks filled with equations, and they say, ah, mathematics. Yeah, we tried that. Yeah. you know, it works just so far, you know. But the real way to describe the universe is this, and they bring out their books. But then when I try to figure out what possibly could be in their book that wouldn't be mathematics, or at least mathematics in disguise, I don't even know – I can't even imagine what it would be.
Right.
And maybe that's just a limitation of my own creativity.
It is, because
things.
I've got it all worked out.
So yeah, it could be that math is ultimately underlying everything.
All right. Brian Greene, I want to turn now to the Amazing Five, which is how I conclude these sessions. I will ask you four amazing recommendations in film, music, television, food, and books.
Wow.
I want to start with film.
Film. Let's see.
And you can go far afield. This does not have to relate to, you know, your particular area of expertise.
So there was a film that I saw not too long ago that seemed not to get much attention that I thought was great. It was called The Music Never Stopped. Are you familiar with that film? Yeah, it's a film that I believe was based on some Oliver Sacks writing or research. I don't remember the exact details. But it was a wonderful story of how music could help people with certain kind of neurological problems sort of come back to life.
And you yourself are a pianist, right? Yeah.
Well, that's overstating it enormously. I and that's probably from that same Wikipedia article because someone else mentioned that to me. You know, I took some piano when I was sort of in college and graduate school because my dad was a composer. Mm. But a kind of frustrated one. So he kind of pushed all his kids away from music. And I kind of wanted to connect with it. So I did that for a while. But I wouldn't in any way, shape, or form describe myself as a pianist. But music is definitely an underlying passion within me, even if it's not something I can do myself.
And the relationship between mathematics and music is quite strong.
Yeah, no, it's all – what is music? It's all about patterns of notes, you know, and finding – you know, harmonious, beautiful, unexpected patterns. And that's what ultimately trying to understand the universe is about.
So the name of the film again?
Music Never Stopped.
Music Never
I hope that's
stopped.
The right title. I think it is.
All right. So we'll go then to music. Some amazing music, you know.
Oh, amazing music. Gosh. You know, I sort of want to come up with something unusual and clever, but it's very hard to.
Doesn't have to be.
If I just tell you what really moves
yes.
me, I'll tell you this. It's
Guns N' Roses.
You got it. You know, Brahms.
Really?
Yeah, Brahms to me somehow has the ability to not just touch me emotionally, but just sort of grabs my insides. And that is not something that I ordinarily experience. In fact, you know, going back to piano, one of the reasons I started taking lessons when I was in college was I went to a concert where the Brahms Rhapsody in G, I think it was played. And I said, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard, and I want to somehow be able to play that. So what I did was, for the next few years, I didn't do the basic stuff. I didn't do scales or Mary Had a Little Lamb. I just dove in to try to play this insanely, you know, for the novice, difficult piece. And within 3 years, I could at least get through the darn thing.
Wow.
And that's pretty much when I stopped.
I understand that. I did the same thing with running. I ran a half marathon, and I was like, I'm done.
Yeah, yeah. So I can play all of one piece.
So if somebody wants to dive into Brahms' Rhapsody in G?
Yeah, I think it's G or G minor, but I'm like, you know.
3 years, you don't even know what it's called?
I'm showing my naivete right there, right? Exactly.
Television.
Television.
Something amazing in TV.
Yeah,
and
don't
you dare tell me you don't watch TV.
Well, I almost never do. Oh. Sorry about that. But my wife and I got sucked in. We're always late to Breaking Bad.
Yep.
And at first, you know, it took a couple episodes, but it became our, you know, our nightly thing. Everything else went away. And it was just watching Breaking Bad. So I know it's old. But it's great.
It ended last year. I wouldn't say it's
old. Yeah, there we go. Okay.
It's of recent vintage.
Yes.
You didn't say Brahms is old. Brahms is older than Breaking Bad.
Without a doubt.
All right.
The other thing on television I'd say is, you know, the old Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
You know. Amazingly that Rod Serling could come up with so many story ideas that each is just, you know, a little gem. They're really quite wonderful.
You're a vegan?
Yes, I am.
Some food you would recommend?
Food I would recommend. Well, you know, Amy's frozen vegan pizza, made not with soy cheese, but with Daiya cheese, to me, rivals any pizza that I've ever had. Now,
having not tried it, I will say this. You're insane.
That's exactly what my wife says. She thinks she cannot, you know, we get along on most everything. But when it comes to food, I think she would divorce me if it took on a larger part of our life. But you got to try it. I'm going to have you over.
Yeah. This is after I go to the lecture.
For Amy's vegan pizza.
I will certainly try it.
Yeah.
All right. And finally, a book.
A book. You know, I've been reading lately Ray Bradbury's short stories. And again, it's sort of like the Twilight Zone thing. But even, you know, taken to the nth degree, this guy, the wealth of creative thinking to come up with these stories that I don't view them as sci-fi. You know, some of them are, you know, within that domain. There are rocket ships and other planets. But he finds the core of our humanity and illuminates it in an unexpected way, in an unexpected domain, in an unexpected time. And I just think they are utter, utter gems, these stories. So I would say the collection of Ray Bradbury stories, a full collection, is a wonderful read.
Well, unexpected explanations and unexpected times, it feels like kind of a theme in this conversation and in your work. And Brian Greene, I want to thank you so much for being part of How to Be Amazing.
Thank you.
And I don't have a fucking sign-off. I need a fucking sign-off. So Brian Greene. Brian Greene, thank you so much for being part of How to Be Amazing. You were amazing. How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. To hear more stories, visit PRX.org. You can like How to Be Amazing on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. Today's show is mixed and edited by Kristen Clark and Barry O'Halloran, with music from Chad Crouch, and also Brahms. I'm Michael Ian Black.